I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
Support comes from Grady Health Foundation, presenting Move for Grady Saturday, April 27th, featuring a family-friendly bike ride through Atlanta's in-town neighborhoods. There's a ride, run, or walk distance for everyone, benefiting Grady Health System. More at moveforgrady.com.
This is Buried Truths. I'm Hank Klibanoff. Today, we're remembering Ahmaud Arbery. It's been 1 year since he was killed while on a Sunday afternoon jog through a residential neighborhood in Brunswick, Georgia. So today, a Buried Truths live event that we held, well, like a lot of things these days, during the pandemic on Zoom. We wanted to share a bit more about what it took to research and produce Season 3, The Story of Ahmaud Arbery. So let's jump right into it. Our moderator for the discussion was Alita McCalman, Director of Education for WABE. She started by introducing the five panel members.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome. I'm so happy to be here with you all. And today I'm honored to bring you guys today's panelists. These wonderful people teamed up to bring you the podcast that you know and love to learn from. I'd like to start with the woman who launched and co-executive produced Buried Truths, J.N. Barry. We also have senior producer at WABE, Dave Barriswain. We have Emory University alum, and he graduated with a bachelor's degree in philosophy and law. This is Sage Mason. I have Emory University senior history and English creative writing double major, currently working on her honors thesis on felony disenfranchisement and voter suppression in Florida, Cameron Katz. And finally, Emory University professor, director of the Civil Rights Cold Cases Project at Emory, co-author of The Race Beat, and you know him as the voice of Buried Truths, narrator and creator Hank Klibanoff. Hello, everyone. Now, before we get started with this conversation, I want to remind the audience of what we got from this current season. So, everyone stay tuned and listen to the Season 3 trailer.
In February 2020, Ahmaud Arbery was out for a Sunday jog in a quiet tree-lined neighborhood near the coast of Georgia. He never made it home.
911, what's the address of your emergency?
I'm out here at Stella Shores. There's a black male running down the street.
Ahmaud was chased down by three men in two trucks and was hit by three shotgun blasts at close range. I'm Hank Klibanoff, host of the podcast Buried Truths. This season isn't just about how Ahmaud Arbery was killed, but why the men chased him in the first place and what it says about the long arc of racial attitudes in America.
This whole thing about it, just a black man jogging down the road in a white neighborhood, was just bullshit.
There's a desire to catch him, dead or alive. So they got their guns and they loaded up like a posse.
Now I'm going to bring you some new details about this case. We'll hear from those who knew Ahmaud Arbery, and we'll learn a lot more about the three men who trapped him on a residential street. I'll trace the roots of their families back hundreds of years and examine their surprising connection to the early days of slavery. And, crucially, I'll examine why it took 74 days to bring criminal charges.
We want Barnhill and Jackie Johnson's job and anybody complicit in the murder and cover-up of Ahmaud. They must go. Say it after me. They must go.
This season of Buried Truths is about a killing that took place in 2020, but it sure feels like a case out of 1950. Maybe that just proves the point we've been making in Buried Truths, that when we understand who we were, we can better understand who we are.
Jan, let's start with you. With the landscape of podcasting changing consistently, how did this show evolve from the idea of what Buried Truths was supposed to be to the version of the podcast that we can hear today?
Sure. I'm happy to take that question. And hi, everyone. Thank you for joining us. So the important thing to know about the backstory here is that we actually started talking about making buried truths in 2016, which is pretty early, right? In podcast land. Podcasts had been around for a bit, but of course, they've continued to increase in popularity every year since then. And when we first started talking about buried truths, we were considering whether it could be a documentary, because that was what was more familiar to us at that point in time. But documentaries are really heavily dependent on visuals. And these are important stories that need to be told, but they don't have a lot of visuals that go with them. And so as we, as Public Broadcasting Atlanta was exploring how it could enter in the podcast space, had this wonderful, rich material, and just an astounding expert who was willing to give his time to the project and work with us to create this podcast and figure out how to translate his class into a podcast, it made sense for us to pursue a podcast instead of a documentary. And we were really intentional about understanding the podcast landscape. We looked at what the shows that were out there, which ones we thought would have comparable listenership. Podcasts, there's a lot of true crime, right? It may go without saying that true crime is one of the most popular genres in podcast listening. And so we saw that there were true crime elements to this story. But we didn't only look at the landscape, we were also really intentional about listening to the audience and getting audience insights. So we did focus groups and we heard loud and clear that it was really important to people to understand the history and get analysis and understand the context. They weren't interested in these stories from kind of a sensationalized true crime angle. They were interested in it from the history and the context. So based on audience insights, based on listening to people who were engaged with the station, who donated to the station, a range of different ages, we decided to frame Buried Truths differently. And it's what sets it apart. It's not just about the crime, but it really digs into the history and the context. And if you want to understand that more, of course, if you haven't already, listen to the show, but also read the comments. I'll be honest, sometimes I just scroll through the comments because it makes me feel so like fulfilled and proud of what we've done. And in those comments that people leave on platforms like Apple Podcasts, you'll get a clear sense of the impact and what sets it apart.
Now, Dave, from my understanding, season 3 was already in the works when the video of Ahmaud Arbery was released. So I'm sure that the people who are watching us right now want to know, when did the pivot happen and what led you all to choose this case to tackle for this season?
Well, certainly we were working on what we thought was going to be season 3, the story of James Brazier. We'll let Hank and talk about that in a minute. But when, you know, if any of us heard about the story of Ahmaud Arbery, you know, it was only in passing. But once that video was released, you know, we, like the rest of the world, were like, wow, what happened here? And Hank sent out an email to the team and he's like, I got an idea. And we were all just reeling from the news. And because the question was, we have the power to do it. Why wouldn't we do it? And so we pivoted from a civil rights cold cases class and doing research from the 1950s to saying, let's do some primary research and get Hank to get his students together and we'll see what we can muster.
So Hank, on the flip side of that, your students were already working on something. Can you share an overview of what your students did this past summer?
Yes. Students, like all of us, were caught a little off guard in the spring when suddenly Emory closes in the middle of our spring break. If they came back, it was just to get their things and go back home or to their apartments, whatever. And quite a few of them lost their summer internships, their summer jobs, their fellowships, things that were really important to them. And these were five students I had identified as really
wonderful in the course that I had taught in fall 2019, which was about the James Brazier case. And so I thought, well, maybe they can work with me on the James Brazier case. But it became pretty clear that we were not going down to Albany, Georgia, and Dawson, Georgia, which had was a center of a major outbreak of COVID-19. And I'm just wondering, well, I'd love to help these students this summer, and I'd love to have their help, but what can we do? And then the Ahmaud Arbery story tragically broke. And I first sent the email to the people at WABE and got that team on board, and then started calling the five of them and saying, how about this summer you sort of pivot and come to work on this project. You know, you see it, you're going to see some of it tonight from what Sage Mason did. I mean, he had did a lot of research into the Glenn County Police Department, which has had a very troubled past filled with tragedy, often inflicted by the Glenn County Police Department. And there were a lot of threats to its survival. He did some terrific interviews that we're going to be talking about. Cameron, you're going to learn more here. Cameron Katz did a lot of genealogical research into the defendants, the McMichaels and Roddy Bryan, and a lot of research in the Brunswick News. Hannah Charik had done some really great research on the history of Glenn County, one of the original seven counties of Georgia in 1777. And in those days, and into the early 1800s, the population of Glenn County was 87% African-American. And that's because they were all enslaved people. She also continued the research to show that by today, it's 70%+ white. And so she explored how that came to be. She explored the creation of the Glenn County Rangers. We had already talked in season two on A.C. Hall, and it's the same here, about how slave patrols became police forces in the South. And so she pinpoints the creation of a group called the Rangers in Glenn County that appear from all evidence we could gather to be a slave patrol, anti-insurrectionists, that sort of thing. Jordan Flowers did some terrific work in helping us set up a grid that in which we populated with the names of classmates, high school classmates of both of the McMichaels. Later, Roddy Bryan, we learned more about as he was arrested. And it, had their phone numbers, people we could call and access to try to learn more. So that was very necessary research. He also found somebody that I owe him an apology for because we didn't pursue, and maybe we'll follow up on that, but someone who seemed to know a lot about the family. And he did great work finding that. And Jake Bush looked into the DA. You've listened to the podcast. There's a lot in there about the DA and Glenn County at the time and nearby. And they're all white in these areas. And Jake looked into the composition, the racial composition of the DAs in the state, and found that very few, I think 7 out of 49, were African-American in the state of Georgia. He also looked at the pertinent laws on stand your ground law, citizens arrest laws and things like that. So I made some calls to some of the classmates of the defendants. They just dove in and their quick studies and found good audio that we could use and to tell this story. I was really impressed.
Sage and Cameron, thank you for joining us. So happy to have you here. You two, you spent your summer in an interesting way, as Hank described. So now that you have experience discovering or researching both cold cases and a case that's currently unfolding, what would you say are some of the differences between the two?
Hey, everybody. I'd say one of the main differences for me was just that in like the past cases, because the Georgia Civil Rights Cold Cases Project happens, I think, just about every year, and they have repeated certain cases as more information has come to light. A lot of it is, in my experience, has been building off of what some of the other students have done in the past, looking into things like deeper. And there's less sort of, there are some instances in which we find like completely new materials, and that's really exciting. There isn't as much of that
when we're looking at these cases that have been kind of examined in the past. But with the Ahmaud Arbery case, it was really interesting because pretty much everything that we found was new.
Yeah, and to add to that too, the level of evidence, you would think that it would be harder to find information on an older case, but I remember on our first day of class, Professor Klibanoff gave us a big packet with all of the FBI information about the Brazier case. So that sort of helped us to get a fuller picture of what went on with that case that we just didn't have access to because the Ahmaud Arbery case was much more recent. And then on the genealogical side of things too, it's much easier to find that kind of information on a more on an older case because the people that you're looking for are deceased. But if you were to go to ancestry.com, you can't just type in someone's name of someone who's alive today and have all of their family history come up. So it was much more challenging, I think, to find, you know, when I was researching the McMichael family and the Bryan family, to find that information because it wasn't as widely available since they're still alive.
I might also add that they were doing this in a pandemic. You know, they couldn't just drive down there and waltz into the courthouse and say, show me your this records or your that records. You know, they were having to use skills that they hadn't had to use in looking at cases where we've actually gone into communities.
That has to add another level of difficulty in not being able to physically speak to people. You know, when you're on the phone with them, they can hang up on you. They have options. So very amazing what you were able to pull out here. Dave and Jayanne, why do you think that these stories, especially these stories from decades ago, why do they matter? Why are they so important for us to tell?
I'll start and then Dave jump in wherever. What is so interesting about that question is in 2016, in 2017, in 2018, in 2019, we found ourselves in a much more explanatory position with that question. The importance of understanding the history and the roots of things, I think, in very painful ways has just come to the surface more this year. But in addition to that, Barry Truths dives into things that a lot of us, we've heard about and we know on a, we might have learned in school, we may know about it on somewhat of a surface level. But the way in which we're able to go in detail over, you know, 6 to 8 or 9 episodes of a story to hear from the people who were impacted. And audio is so intimate, right? And so we've gotten letters from people in other countries, people who have gone through, have lived through some of these experiences in their lives. And it's just brought up things for them that were really hard and traumatic, but which they also found some release from. I remember one email in particular where a man in his 70s wrote to Hank and talked about how he cried listening to the episodes. And so I think that kind of for two different audience segments, there's deep value. There's a value and honestly a trauma, right? That may come about for people for whom this podcast brings up things that they've had to suppress to cope. And I like had a friend's father tell me that. He said, you know, I can't listen to that podcast. Like I'm proud of the work that you did, but I can't because I need to go to work and I just need to function. And he said, you read about that in books. I lived it, right? But for those of us who've read about it in books, it helps make it more tangible and I think is just such an instrumental tool. And it speaks to why we were able, you were able specifically, Alita, to partner with the Georgia Department of Education to get Barry Truth's curriculum rolled out to social studies teachers across the state.
And the response to that curriculum was great.
And what I like about, you know, some of the stories that we have done is there's an invisible line of empathy that goes back into the past and helps to explain frustrations among minority communities that maybe you didn't see because, as Jayanne is saying, you just didn't live it. But even for this next generation, Jayanne, I don't know if you're making reference to the letter we got from the listener in the listener from France, he had always tried to explain what Jim Crow was to his kids. And, you know, it was a mix of words and just kind of a, if you understood from where, what I lived anyway, he insisted that his kids listen to this podcast because that framed up what it was like. And when we have that understanding, you know, we have this through line of empathy. I call it this bridge of empathy. And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to connect those that understand to those that don't, and those that don't have empathy to reasons why maybe they could consider it.
Beautiful. Now, Hank, a lot of the work behind this show relies heavily on your students from your Civil Rights Cold Cases Project at Emory. And I want you to explain to the audience how important their work is, and also your work, because you're molding these minds, right? But for those of you in the audience who may need a refresher, I want to play a clip of one of your students, Ellie Studdard, in one of the most key moments in season one.
In the 67 years since Isaiah Nixon was buried here, no one has found his gravesite. His mother, some of his children, have died, not knowing where he rests.
Waiting on his veterans' headstone.
Right. Your brothers.
We've been guided to this cemetery by John Harris's son, James. And when we get out of our car, the students start drifting slowly through the headstones. I know that James Harris's parents are buried here, so I ask him to show me where they are. And we start walking. And then one of my students, Ellie Studdard, yells out something. Now you have to listen carefully past the sound of footsteps. Ellie's words changed everything. Here is the moment.
I found it.
That's right. Ellie Studdard had found the gravesite of Isaiah Nixon, and her discovery was about to change the world of Dorothy Nixon.
She had found Isaiah Nixon's gravesite because there was a slab of cement over him that had gotten grown over for years with weeds and mud and leaves, and some pounding rain or a high wind or something had spread some of that away, and she could see under that an I and an S. And she began digging. She sees SEP, and the students are pretty keen to know exactly when somebody died. It said September 10th, 1948, and she knew that was him. That's when she yelled it. And then we're all on our hands and knees and clearing the gravesite. And what the picture you saw was Dorothy, his daughter, coming back to it and seeing it for the first time in her life and for the first time in 67 years.
Amazing. What made you sign up for this class, for the Civil Rights Cold Cases class?
Well, I did not know that the class existed. I didn't know who Professor Klibanoff was.
Incidentally, this is one of my students, Sage Mason.
I had a project for an unrelated class where I had to create a short documentary. So I went on Wikipedia and I just looked up like notable Emory professors, and Professor Klibanoff was there. So I sent him an email, not really even expecting him to like respond anytime soon. But then he responded and he was like, yeah, Sage, come by, you know, later on this week. And he was just like the nicest guy in the world, super down to earth. And his passion for his work really just, because a lot of what we talked about was the Georgia Civil Rights Cold Cases Project. And he just like really inspired me about everything. And I was like, I have to take this class.
Cameron, what brought you to the class?
Since you can't see what's happening, let me tell you that this is the other student on the panel tonight, Cameron Katz.
The Georgia Cold Cases class really sat at a nice intersection of my majors between history and creative writing. So that was one reason that I was really interested in it. A lot of my creative writing is mostly in fiction, and the idea of getting involved in journalism and nonfiction had always been sort of interesting to me, but I'd never really had a chance to pursue it. A lot of the history classes that I had been taking up to that point, I took it in the fall of my junior year, had been a lot about racial justice. And that was sort of the path that I seemed to be following. And I had heard really great things about the course and, you know, would get emails from the creative writing department about how amazing the project was. So I just decided to apply and, you know, see how it went. And it was just an incredible experience. It was so much more hands-on than I'd been expecting, because, you know, most of the history classes that I take, the information is all there and you sit down and the professor tells you about it and then you take notes and you leave. But it was not like that at all with this course. And it also really helped me to understand how I could merge creative writing and history together to bring a sort of storytelling element to these really important aspects of our history. And I think that's a skill that I've brought into, you know, the more academia settings for a history classroom, of just being able to tell a story that's accessible to the general public. Because that's one thing that's so great about this podcast, is that it sort of brings these really important stories that don't necessarily make it into the history textbooks to a general audience, where they can be heard and understood and appreciated.
Now, Hank, several times this season, we heard about Ahmaud Arbery running through a neighborhood and people in that neighborhood saying he just has no business being there. And that makes me think of a clip from this season, and I wanted to play it. It's from attorney Jim Barger. But before we press play on that clip, can you remind us who Jim Barger is and why it's important to the podcast?
So Jim Barger is an attorney who lives in St. Simons, and he also teaches law at the University of Alabama. But his real interest is in Southern culture. And he actually got his master's degree at a place I'm very familiar with, the Center for the Study of Southern Culture at the University of Mississippi. And living down on the coast, he is very knowledgeable about the Gullah and the Geechee cultures, about Sapelo Island, the various islands, about the people there. And and by the way, one of the elements of our podcast that I just love is, and we won't go into it in detail tonight, but is the history of Sapelo Island and the history of the enslaved people of Sapelo Island, okay? Because that's the origins of Ahmaud Arbery's history, okay? Ahmaud Arbery's people go all the way back to the late 1700s, and they were enslaved. Jim wrote a piece for the online magazine Bitter Southerner that was so enlightening and so beautifully written. And so I called him and we interviewed him on multiple occasions. And he just had a point of view about his shock that three white men look at a black man running through the neighborhood and say, he doesn't belong here. Who is he? This is our place. And Jim, you will hear in this clip, is saying, uh-uh, you got that wrong. You know, he goes way, way back, too.
I always felt like St. Simons and the Golden Isles belonged to the Geechees. And so this idea that a descendant of the Geechees couldn't run wherever he wanted to run is such a misinterpretation of place. They killed him because they thought he didn't belong there. I've studied enough and encountered enough personally and lived here long enough to know that nobody belonged here more than he did. You can't understand or fully appreciate the Golden Isles unless you understand the heritage of the black people who have lived here since the 1600s.
He said it plainly.
He did. And it changed. Once you know that, it changes everything in your understanding of what was going on that day. You know, and that's where history is talking to us today and saying, You are so misunderstanding if you think that he was invading their turf.
You love free, and at Ameris Bank, so do we. That's why we're proud to offer worry-free, hassle-free Ameris Bank free checking. Manage your money your way with convenient access to digital, mobile, and telephone banking, all with no monthly service fee or minimum balance requirements. At Ameris Bank, we're with you. For more information or to open an account, visit our local bankers in person or online at amerisbank.com/free checking. Other fees such as overdraft fees may apply. Ameris Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Support for WABE's local coverage on maternal health and mortality comes from Georgia Health Initiative, whose mission is to inspire and promote collective action that advances health equity for all Georgians. Learn more at georgiahealthinitiative.org.
Since we're in history, and we're talking about history and backgrounds and where people come from. Cameron, you were able to uncover a lot of information on the background and the genealogy of the McMichaels and Roddy Bryan. What was one of the most shocking things that you discovered in your research?
I think the most shocking thing to me was just how recent this history is, because, you know, in history courses and when we're talking about the Civil War, we talk about it like it's something that's so far removed from the America that we know today. And, you know, many of the modern American history classes that I'll take at Emory start, like the time period they start is after the Civil War. But if you look at the family tree, it was Greg McMichael's great-grandfather, only his great-grandfather, that fought in the Civil War. And you can see the family tree on the screen. And that's pretty incredible to see that, you know, it was just a couple of generations back that this, you know, dark, bloody moment in our history, you know, is not as far removed as we think. I think if we're looking at where we are now and understanding why we are the way that we are, we need to understand that, you know, the Civil War and even, you know, the period of enslavement in the United States is not that far removed from the present. And that was really, it was really surprising to see that on the family tree and the way that you're seeing it right now.
And what you can't see right now is the visual of Greg and Travis McMichael's family tree that my student Cameron Katz researched.
And how did you gather this information? What was your process?
I went to White Pages of all places first. And White Pages does this really creepy thing where it tells you, you know, who has lived in your household. And that's how I was able to find Greg McMichael's mother, who passed away in 2005, I think it was. And from there, because she was deceased, I was able to use her name on Ancestry and then sort of trace it backwards. And if you go to the next slide, you'll see some of the documents that I was able to find from the McMichael family. So on the right side there, you can see the enlistment papers for Jacob Jefferson Johns, who was Greg McMichael's great-grandfather who fought in the Civil War. And so I could find that on a soldier database. And then the National Parks Service actually has another database where you can find the battalion, where he was positioned, his rank, and all of that information. And remarkably, he didn't really move outside of that coastal Georgia area, even during the Civil War, which was a lot of great confirmation. I brought that to Professor Klibanoff, and I was, you know, so excited that we had made this discovery. And of course, he was excited too, but then asked, you know, can we go back further? And so that's when I found the 1850 slave schedule, which was a document that was a part of the 1850 census that recorded which people enslaved other people and basically recorded. You'll see if you on this zoomed in section right here, how many enslaved people were under this property. And from all of the genealogical research and the family tree that I had reconstructed, you could find, you know, the ancestor who had owned slaves at that time.
We also learned more about Greg McMichael because of this podcast, but there was a graphic moment of him turning Ahmaud over as he lay on the ground. And I want to ask you about that, Hank, but first, for context, I want to play a clip that has, it's actually you quoting from what was characterized as a police report, but it was really just Greg McMichael's version of the event that led to the killing of Ahmaud. So, take a listen.
McMichael stated, "The male fell face down on the pavement with his hand under his body." McMichael stated, "He rolled the man over to see if the male had a gun. I observed blood on McMichael's hand from rolling the unidentified male over." So nowhere does the report, and that word really belongs in quotes because it's not a report, it's just a defendant's statement. Nowhere does it answer the obvious question. When McMichael rolled the man over, to use the officer's description, what did he find?
What did he find?
And he didn't find a gun, which really badly damaged what later became the defendant's position that they acted in self-defense. Okay. Now, they are still claiming that because of other circumstances when that involved in the moment that Travis McMichael shot Ahmaud Arbery three times. But right now, what we know then is that he lost the self-defense argument over that. And the police officer who took the report, and he's taken the report from Greg McMichael, who used to work at the Glenn County Police Department. You know, he's sharing with the guy, "Hey, buddy, I used to work there. You know, so-and-so. Yeah, we're all buddies, you know." He didn't point out in the police report that Ahmaud Arbery was not armed, that he had no gun, that he could not have been firing a gun or hiding a gun or anything like that. So that kind of undermined any self-defense claim.
You guys had to talk to a lot of people for this podcast and conducting phone interviews, young people, Cameron, Sage, you guys had to conduct phone interviews and talk to all these people. Sage, you spoke to the Brunswick attorney that we heard in the trailer at the top of the show. He was friends with the McMichaels and he was responsible for the video of the white men chasing and shooting Ahmaud Arbery to go public. So we're going to play a quick clip that we didn't hear in the podcast, but it kind of speaks to the demeanor of Alan Tucker. And Sage, I want you to talk about that when we get finished here.
You know, I'm still shaping my views on the whole world.
I understand.
But yeah, I guess.
Can I tell you something?
Yeah. Go ahead.
don't take this the wrong way. Please don't take this the wrong way. Because it's not being ugly. Your views will change the older you get and the more you acquire. And after you've had your shit taken and your house has been burglarized a couple of times, your opinions will change.
Says your opinions will change. So, Sage, what was he talking about? Well, a few questions. What was he talking about? And what did you think about his brutal honesty in this interview with him?
I mean, a lot of our conversation was us sort of, in a way, like I was trying to be as friendly as possible to keep him talking. But a lot of it was, you know, like obviously disagreement because he thinks that, you know, the actions of the McMichaels were justified. And I, you know, obviously do not. And there he was trying to, he was like, Sage, he kind of narrowed down my thinking into like, you just haven't lived enough life yet. And, you know, if you, you know, had property, if you, you know, had gone through these life experiences, then you too would understand that what the McMichaels did was justified because they were just trying to like protect their neighborhood. Whereas like my whole disagreement there is like, well, they had, even if they think that's what they were doing, what right did they have to, you know, go and stop Ahmaud Arbery anyway? And then what did I think of his brutal honesty? Like as it benefits the podcast, I was really appreciative of it. I thought it was great that he was like saying all of these things. I think it's important that we have that sort of diversity of opinion. I was definitely surprised, you know, him being a lawyer and him being connected to the McMichaels, that he was so eager to, you know, talk to me. But I really enjoyed my conversation with him. You know, there's a lot of disagreement, a lot of like jousting, but I learned a lot about sort of the kind of people who might see the other side of this incident.
And you know, Sage had a moment, you know, as Alan Tucker was talking, he said, you know, really race didn't have anything to do with this. And then Sage said, well, what about, you know, what he said over the body of Ahmaud Arbery using the N-word? And Sage says, doesn't that prove this may have been racially motivated? Sage, what did he say?
And he was like, well, it's definitely a problem. But people, you know, sometimes say things that they shouldn't say when they're in like the heat of the moment. And I was like, well, like, one, that doesn't justify anything. And two, that's exactly like, so it must have been like racially motivated if, you know, even in the heat of the moment, he made that racial remark. But I tried to like be respectful of, you know, his opinions. I think it's important that he was heard.
Well, I would like to thank all of the panelists for joining us. Thank you all so much. I want us to get to the Q&A. We have some questions buzzing in the chat, so I do want to give the audience some time to ask their questions. So let us begin with, there's a two-parter. This is for you, Hank. How do you pick the cold cases to pursue in the class, and how many cases is the class pursuing in a given semester or time period?
Okay. Let me answer the second question first, just because I always like complicating things. Okay. I only teach one course per semester, per semester, and all students are investigating the same case, but different aspects of it. Okay. I know of another program at a law school where each student gets a case, you just can't get that much done in a semester's time if one student's doing it. So we do that. The other is, originally the list was drawn, all the cases were from the modern civil rights era, from post-World War II to 1968, 1970. That's Isaiah Nixon, that's A.C. Hall, that's James Brazier. And they were all on a list of cases that the FBI gathered. They actually borrowed the list from the Southern Poverty Law Center of cases that are racially motivated and unsolved, unpunished. And I just started with that list. And there were about 19 or 20 Georgia victims. And that includes the four Morris Ford that many know about from 1946. These are cases in which I, well before class begins, will spend some time, and I've done this with other researchers, doing freedom of information requests to the FBI, to the National Archives, to try to get, you know, that sort of, in effect, the textbook that the students are going to use. It might be 135 pages, it might be 12 pages, but whatever it is, I mean, all we got out of the FOIA Freedom of Information Act request on the A.C. Hall case was the coroner's transcript, but we sure made a lot out of that. So I think that, you know, this is a departure because it's not 1945 to 1968, you know? And I'll be honest, the class I taught this past semester was out of that range also. I taught the 1906 Atlanta race riot, which should be branded, and we did rebrand it, the 1906 Atlanta race massacre. And that was really eye-opening to me, you know. But it was a fantastic course, and we learned a lot, and I'm not sure where we go with it from there, but we learned a lot about the 34 people, or some 26 people whose names are on the Equal Justice Initiative monument in Montgomery, who were killed in the 1906 Atlanta race riot massacre of September 1906.
There is a question for you all, actually. So there's the clip that talked about Talmadge's, the clip of Talmadge talking about his stump speech and inciting violence. And what are your thoughts on that with respect to last week's speech and the violence at the Capitol?
So I'm going to jump in right here simply to mention that the clip Alita is talking about is something the Zoom audience heard as the event was kicking off. It's an excerpt from the trailer from season one, The Story of Isaiah Nixon. It includes comments made by Gene Talmadge, who was running for his fourth term as governor of Georgia. So we'll play the clip, and then I'll answer the question about the violence at the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021.
So here's a true story from the 1940s. A top Klansman, the exalted Cyclops, approaches the longtime Georgia governor Eugene Talmadge. The Klansman's upset. Turns out the U.S. Supreme Court has just ruled that blacks in Georgia must be allowed to vote in the upcoming Democratic Party primary. The worried Klansman turns to Talmadge, wondering what they can do now. How are we going to keep them from the polls? Talmadge, the Klansman later recalled, didn't say anything. Instead, he picked up a scrap of paper and wrote one word on it. Pistols. White supremacy. It survived and thrived because it was fueled by violence, racial myths, and incendiary rhetoric. To hear that rhetoric, listen to this old recording. It's a stump speech Gene Talmadge gave in Columbus, Georgia, in the summer of 1946.
Now, what do my opponents say? They say that it's the law and Negroes will vote in the primary. But if I'm your governor, They won't vote in our white primary the next 4 years.
Speeches like this, they were not uncommon. And they had a consequence. They had the power to incite and to mobilize whites against blacks.
It is absolutely a very clear echo. And by the way, that was said in the privacy of Talmadge's office. But at the same time, on the floor of the United States Senate, another, you know, a Talmadge-like public figure, Theodore Bilbo of Mississippi, who had been governor and then in 46 was U.S. Senator. And he stood up on the floor of the United States Senate right after the Supreme Court had said to Georgia, you must allow blacks to vote in the Democratic Party primary. And that's what led Talmadge's person there to say, what are we going to do now, government? He writes pistols. Bilbo says on the floor of the Senate, well, what that means, guys, that means that if we're going to stop them from voting, we're going to have to do it the night before, which is pretty chilling. But that was the attitude, and he had no compunction about saying that in public. So what you hear from there, you heard magnified a hundredfold on the streets of Washington, D.C., as those people left the stage, and from the stage you heard it, and then marching to the center of government.
Sage and Cameron, question for you guys. How did this work change your perspective on the United States and what's taught regarding race relations?
I could really like go off about this because it wasn't just this class, but a lot of the classes that, you know, I've taken in college that have really reshaped, you know, the way that I understand our history. And I think that perspective was really shown with what we saw at the Capitol. And just seeing, you know, that there is this darker history of racism that has not gone away. One of my other professors, Carol Anderson, said a quote in a class I took last semester that I love, that's, we have to understand America as an aspiration. And instead of understanding our country as, you know, it's always been perfect and this is, you know, it's always been equal and that's not the case, but we have in our history this aspiration towards, you know, we the people, and that we're all striving towards this.
Yeah, piggybacking off of that, I think my sort of educational experience has been kind of different from Cameron's. I'm from New York City, and I went to like a pretty progressive institutions throughout my life. And especially in New York, it almost seemed like, I think, you know, my curriculum like throughout my life has done like a really good job of investigating race and, you know, its ugly history, but it was like so progressive that it seemed so like starkly different from sort of the reality I was experiencing that it almost seemed like all of these problems had been solved. And that was, you know, almost like confirmed internally when Barack Obama was elected president when I was in, you know, middle school. But then I guess with this work, with the Georgia Civil Rights Cold Cases Project, you know, I'm sort of reminded that we haven't made such, you know, great strides in the, you know, repairing of these, you know, racial issues.
For Hank, Jan, and Dave, combining questions here, what has been the impact of this podcast? What doors have been open? Has anything changed in these cases based on the podcast content? What has happened once the podcast gets out there?
I can't say that I actually know, to be honest with you. Can't say I don't know if the prosecutor has listened to it. You know, I don't know if the judge has listened to it. I don't know. I know the family of Ahmaud Arbery early on was reluctant to listen to it. One of them did and said, it's really hard to listen to this. It's really hard to relive it. And we, you know, we were thinking about the family when we did it, but at the same time, we were going to do it in a way that was faithful to what happened. And as you know, Alita and Dave and Jan know, you know, we had a serious discussion. Are we going to carry the sound of the three shotgun blasts that killed Ahmaud Arbery? Because that can be really jolting and really disturbing and traumatizing for people, including the family. And we ultimately decided, well, of course, well, I shouldn't say of course, because we did discuss it. But yes, we are going to carry that sound. And as bad as we're going to feel about re-traumatizing the family, though they've heard it again and again, if it's been on TV so many times, that sound needs to be heard by people who have never heard it before. But I don't know beyond that, you know, I don't know if that influenced the judge's decision to keep them in jail. You know, I really don't know. And I haven't really asked. You know, we put it out there, let it do its own work. You know, I don't need to be lobbying for people to let it influence them.
You know, and I think as it is, and Hank and I had talked about this, and we talked about, you know, how it would affect the family. But there is, on the other side of that, it is discovery. And it goes back to what I was saying about empathy. For those that have never heard or never walked in shoes or never quite understood the case, or, you know, my friends who listened to it, they had no idea. They were like, what? That's what happened? So there's a lot of people out there who are discovering, you know, what's happened in the very short life of Ahmaud Arbery.
Yeah, and I would add that I think as we were just defining what buried truths would be, right, and the differences between it and some of the true crime podcasts out there, many of which are very good, but that get some of their oomph from, like, is this going to lead to developments in the case, send in tips, et cetera. Thinking about the first two seasons of Buried Truths, we knew that that wasn't the case, right? The perpetrators have deceased, the victims and their families, you know, they're generations down the line, but it's far removed. And yet, to Dave's point, that's not what's important, right? It's about the empathy, the learning, the education, and the deep dive that we're giving to the stories, in spite of the fact that it doesn't have some of those elements.
We did have one unexpected outcome from the first season, if you recall, after, and it, not so much from the podcast, I wouldn't say, but it really, we were able to catch it in the podcast. And that was when Dorothy Nixon Williams goes back to see her father's gravesite, and a Wall Street Journal reporter happened to be there and wrote about it. And somehow or other, we get a response from the nephew of the two men who killed Isaiah Nixon, who said, I want to talk to you, you know, and he ultimately just wanted to apologize to the family. And that is a golden moment. And we were there to record that apology. You know, it's all wrapped into the first season of the podcast. And if this Ahmaud Arbery led anyone to want to say, I'm sorry, to say, my mind has been warped on these issues, I'd say, speak up. We'd love to hear from you.
And you know, there's one thing that Jim Barger had told us, Hank, you may have to remind me, but his original expose, while it may have gone out in the Bitter Southerner or wherever he published it first, he did put it on his social media account, and he did it with some, do you remember what he said? Was it like trepidation? He's just not sure how that community was going to receive it. And he received overwhelming support on his views in the community that, you know, we could from afar quickly dismiss.
By the way, I don't know how much influence our podcast had on this, but many people may know that Jackie Johnson, the district attorney, who was neck deep in this case, so she said she was recused herself, but neck deep by not following regular procedure and deciding who would take the case for her. She was defeated in the election this year, just in November. That was the first time in a quarter of a century that an incumbent DA had been challenged, and she lost.
This leads me to another question. with the few minutes we have left, how are you able to stay objective enough to work on this story? And what are your thoughts now after learning and hearing so much in this current day story?
I could give a long talk on the role of objectivity in journalism. I will tell you, during the research phase, if we don't know anything, we're just hungry for information, and we're not going at it necessarily with an agenda. But clearly, you might start with a thesis and a theory and on any number of things. I would not have started off with the theory or the thesis that the second district attorney, Barnhill of Waycross, Georgia, started with, which was surely for Ahmaud Arbery to be running through that neighborhood on that day, he must have been high on something, you know. And so he orders toxicology exams, not on the men who killed him, not on the three men who were impulsed. You know, I had this impulsive urge to chase him in cars with guns. He ordered toxicology reports on Ahmaud Arbery, the deceased, and they all came back negative. You know, when I said, let's go back into the past of the McMichaels, maybe they go back to the Confederacy. That is not incriminating. We point out that, you know, that's not a genetic defect, you know, to be the descendant of someone who fought for the Confederacy. But we do want to know. And sure enough, given the role of slavery, the incredible role of slavery in that region, it was, you know, didn't stun me totally to see that Cameron found out that indeed the McMichael family owned slaves. And if something doesn't pan out, you move on to something else. And objectivity, by the way, doesn't mean that you don't start off with some ideas and go after them. I mean, there's nothing wrong with investigative journalism that starts off with a thesis. And if it's true, you're going to publish it. And we found some things here we thought were true, and we published them.
Well, Cameron Katz, Sage Mason, Dave Barriswain, Jan Barry, and Hank Klibanoff, thank you so much for your time, for speaking with us.
As we're wrapping up, I want to let you know that very soon, in fact, as soon as today, we're going to bring you an update about where we are with the legal case against the three men who chased Ahmaud Arbery in their trucks, as well as legislation that's been generated in the aftermath of his death. To help tell it, we've been invited to be part of a live radio show called Closer Look, produced by WABE Atlanta and hosted by Rose Scott. Together, we're going to look through what's happened in the time since Ahmaud Arbery's death and what new details have been revealed. Finally, I'd like to thank the folks here at WABE for helping to tell this story. And also a big thanks to Richard Hallux and especially my students in the Georgia Civil Rights Cold Cases class at Emory University who have helped so much with the research of Buried Truths Season 3. And I'd also like to thank a couple of folks behind the scenes who helped us to really understand Ahmaud's hometown and his life, Jim Berger and Jazz Watts. Buried Truths is a production of WABE Atlanta. I'm Hank Klibanoff.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The world is full of mysteries. Are ghosts real? Is that yogurt expired? Hey, the unknown can be scary, but when you donate to WABE, you know where your money is going. Your gift supports the journalism that keeps you informed and the programs that pull back the curtain on complicated stories. Help us make the world less mysterious. Become a member now. Go online to wabe.org/donate, and thanks.